from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Andrew Solomon, who wrote the National Book Award-winning Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell and an LGBT arts and mental health activist who serves, in fact, as an advisor on LGBT affairs at Yale. He's also the author of the novel A Stone Boat, and he most recently published a book on parents, children, and the search for identity called Far From the Tree, which won the 2012 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. He joins us. Delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Well, let me begin by sort of talking a little bit with you about what you call horizontal identity, because it covers such a broad spectrum. And in fact, I want to talk with you about that spectrum. But those who are listening, we're talking about Down syndrome and autism and schizophrenia and homosexuality and transgender identity, deafness, things that parents believe in many cases when they have children who are born with these horizontal identities, which become horizontal identities, think they need to correct.
I hatched the idea as I worked on the book that there are really two kinds of identity. There are vertical identities that get passed down generationally from parent to child, one's ethnicity, one's nationality, often one's religion, one's language. And then there are the identities that have to be discovered from a peer group because parents don't have them in common with their children. And what I realized is that even though some of the vertical identities, those ones that get passed down generationally, can be difficult, even though you might argue that it's easier in the United States, the current presidency notwithstanding, to be a white person than a person of color. Nobody tries to cure ethnicity. The horizontal identities, these things people don't have in common with their parents, are always people have always tried to cure them because they've made the parents terribly uncomfortable. And so parents with very young children, if they have deaf children, try to make them function in the hearing world. If they have transgender children, tend to try to make them conform to the gender standards of the world. And bit by bit, we're seeing a loosening of that tradition and a greater acceptance of children in all of their difference. And that was really part of what I was chronicling in the book.
And that's heartening. It's also heartening to read some of these stories because they're really stories of great love and loving children in ways that are quite elevating of our humanity and accepting them and accepting them as they move into the peer groups that they are identified with. But of course, in many cases, the parents do not accept, and there are sad stories, a legion number of sad stories as well.
I really wanted to look mostly at the dynamics of resilience. So the book is not full of stories of people who've rejected their children. Now, it's also the case that people who've rejected their children are less interested in talking to an interviewer than are people who have really found a way through. But I do have a few people in the book who, one who gave her child up for care, one who said, I have these autistic children, I love them and I do everything for them, and if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have them. So I got people who took those strong positions. Even for the people where there was a triumph, though, there was a struggle to get there. And I looked a lot in the book at the relationship between love, which in most instances is there quite early between parents and children, and acceptance, which can take decades to negotiate if they get there at all.
What about the semantics, though? Horizontal identity, you know, sounds okay, I suppose, but it's a lot better than words like defective or syndrome or illness, as you point out, which are often used instead and are pejorative. But even when you talk about different or exceptional, it doesn't seem to quite hit the mark. There should be a word for this, shouldn't there, besides horizontal or different?
There should be a word for it, and maybe we can hatch one by the end of the program. I was very struck as I worked on this project by the fact that all of these experiences have a great deal in common. The experience of having a child with schizophrenia surprisingly has a lot with having a child who's a musical prodigy, which is one of my chapters, has a lot in common with having a child who is a dwarf. These things all have a lot in common, but I don't think they've been grouped together very much in the past. And so I think we really do need a term for them. What are these qualities that people have that they have to discover as identities outside of the family setting?
Well, there are things often that isolate, of course. And as you say, as your title suggests, the apple can often fall in another orchard, I think is the way you put it, as opposed to falling not far from the tree or the chip off the old block. Have you found, I'm interested in the response to your book, I mean, particularly people who say, maybe, I don't know if I want to be lumped together with criminals or, you know, don't necessarily want to be identified as part of this kind of group that you're sort of using here.
it was a sign to me that I was onto something, that everyone in the book objected to the other chapters that were in the book. The people with autism said, but we're so much brighter than the people with Down syndrome. The people who were criminals said, okay, but we're not as way out as those transgender people. The people who were deaf said, we have a lively, vital culture and we aren't like people with extreme disabilities. So there was a lot of resistance all the way around. I'm pleased to say that many of the people who were resistant, having now read the book, have recognized that they do have a certain amount in common with the other people in the book. I really think that the negotiation of difference within families is a near universal, that there's nobody who hasn't occasionally looked at his child and thought, what planet did you come from? And that actually the process of dealing with those differences, of negotiating those differences, is something people have in common. And that if people only understand that all of these various kinds of differences are in some ways the same, then they find themselves not in the small silo of parents of a schizophrenic or parents of a dwarf or parents of someone with Down syndrome, but rather in this embracing company of parents dealing with children who are different. And I put in the prodigies to demonstrate that, well, it's less sad to have a child with a difference that's construed positively. It's not actually easier.
I was talking with Andrew Solomon. His book is Far From the Tree, and you take the daring task of writing about your own exceptional life. I mean, growing up not only gay, but also growing up dyslexic and coming to grips with those identities. In fact, I noted before we went on the air here that you're wearing a pink shirt and you tell a story about a pink balloon as a boy, right? You wanted a pink balloon.
Yes. I went with my mother and my brother to a shoe store, Indian Walk Shoes. I don't think that name would go down so well today. And at the end of getting our shoes fitted, we were told by the salesman that each of us could have a balloon to take home. And my brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said, I think you'd really rather have a blue balloon. And I said, no, I really wanted the pink balloon.
Your mother's voice very well, I think.
Thank you. She reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, gives you some evidence, I think, of my mother's influence and its limits.
But your mother was extraordinary in many ways. I mean, I must confess, in reading about your childhood, I felt very touched and moved by just what you went through as a kid, being gay and feeling so isolated. But your mother also worked with your dyslexia and worked assiduously with it in ways that are really remarkable.
When I was applying to elementary schools in New York, or when my parents were applying for me, I was turned down by every place we applied on grounds that I would never learn to read or write. And I've had many problems in life, and that isn't one of them. But my mother did. She sat with me for hours and hours and hours, and she made learning to read our kind of mutual shared fun project. And I love doing it, and I think that it helped me to become an avid reader starting very early on. She was extraordinary in that. I mean, I've said in the book that I feel as though the dyslexia I learned to compensate for, and the fact that I did that so successfully set the stage for the hopes that somehow I could also compensate for or adjust away from being gay. I feel like if actually it had been easy to stop being gay but impossible to resolve the dyslexia, then I would have an identity primarily as a dyslexic and not as a gay person. It's the things that are immutable that end up defining us. But I had those things, and I still have very bad dysgraphia. I'm on book tour. I have to sign people's books. I'm constantly getting letters out of order in people's names.
And how do you go from depression to this topic? Is there a trajectory there?
I think the underlying theme in my work is resilience. My first book was about a group of Soviet artists and how their lives changed during Glasnost. And it was ultimately, I now realize, I didn't realize then, a book about how people took a circumstance of great adversity and found in it an occasion for dignity. Then I wrote a novel called A Stone Boat that was loosely based on my mother's illness and death. And there again, it was a matter of taking this terrible adversity we were all facing and my mother's attempt to turn it into an occasion of privilege and to give it some element, not quite of rapture, but anyway, of a sort of profound bonding that took place in the period of her illness. The depression book, I certainly haven't said that depressions are wonderful and everyone should have them, but I've said that the surest way to cope with the possibility of having a depression is by looking into it and seeing if there are any valuable lessons to be taken from it. That valuing the depression, while it doesn't prevent relapse, may make the relapse less obtrusive when it comes, or make you better able to tolerate it. And then this book is really about how all of these families had children who were the exact opposite of what they wanted, and came to love those children, and came to find meaning in the experience, and came to say, well, I would like to help my child have less pain, more communication skills, whatever it is. I wouldn't want to exchange my child for any other child in the world.
What distinguishes, if anything, those families from other families? I mean, families learning to accept and even celebrate the differences of their children. You know, I think about Anna Karenina and Tolstoy, all happy families are alike and all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. But what makes these families really able to have this resilience and love?
I would argue with Tolstoy, because I think many of the families I wrote about, even though they have the external trappings of what seemed like reasons for unhappiness, were happy families, and I felt they were all happy in their own ways. So I think it's a question of deciding to seek for some meaning in the experience. I was always very struck by the words from one mother who had a child with multiple severe disabilities, who had then... In fact, she had two children with multiple severe disabilities, and she and her husband had ended up describing a spiritual journey that came of their experience of raising those children. And she said to me, I think it's not believing in God that's given us this perspective. People always give us these little sayings like, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And I felt, even though some of the people in the book were in fact motivated by faith, but I felt that that choice to experience these children as a gift and to say, how can I grow and learn from this? And how can I give my child the maximum amount of happiness and fulfillment he's capable of? Those missions became very urgent for the parents I was writing about, very profound and in many ways very rewarding.
It's also, in reading your book, I discovered some, because you've done a lot of research and commend you for a lot of the research, some things that just probably never might occur to people, like abusive fathers being less abusive to those who resemble them physically.
Yes, that was a fascinating study when I came across it. In many ways, we treat better children who resemble us more. The natural impulse is to treat those children better. And frequently, the children who are very different seem harder to love. But what I found as I interviewed all of these families is that actually mastering that difficulty can be a very intimate experience. If you have a child who has any of the different kinds of needs or unusual characteristics that I've described, it takes more of a leap of the imagination to be able to love that child. But there's more imagination in the world than you'd think. And there are a lot of people who have really said that it was a profoundly growing and strengthening experience for them. I mean, I think of Tom and Karen Robards, a family in New York who have a son with Down syndrome. And they were hard-charging Wall Street types, never anticipated having such a child, then did have this child and were struggling to figure out what to do with him, and felt the educational options that were available were very limited. And so with two other families, they started a tiny little education program for their three children, which has since grown into something called the Cook Center that's educated untold thousands of people with intellectual disabilities. And his mother said to me, I said to her, do you wish you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish your son didn't have it? She said, well, I wish for him that he didn't have it because he has a hard life and I think he would have an easier life if he didn't have it. But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 25 years ago that I could come to such a point. I have. For him, I would change it. But for myself, it's made me so much more purposeful and given my life so much more urgency and meaning that for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
Well, we're talking, I think, in some ways about not only acceptance and growing with the child that is different, but above all, loving.
Yes. And I really felt that most of the parents I talked to loved their children even when they found the life experience that they had with those children extremely difficult. And I feel like the love counts for a great deal. I mean, there was one person in the book who's a dwarf who, when he was born with a very disabling condition called diastrophic dwarfism, and his parents were told that he would never learn to walk or talk and that they should just leave him to die quietly at the hospital. And they didn't. They took him home, and they helped him to grow into a really quite remarkable young man who ended up being one of the first people in his family to get a college education and went on to do all kinds of things. And I said to his mother, what do you think you did that allowed him to emerge as such an extraordinary, accomplished, appealing, articulate young man? And she said, what did we do? We loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him, and we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there.
Our guest again, Andrew Solomon, been through the kind of experiences we're talking about, which sometimes are referred to as landing in Holland.
Yes. Emily Pearl Kingsley, who was a writer for Sesame Street, had a son with Down syndrome in the 1970s when people with Down syndrome were really largely invisible. And she got her son on Sesame Street on camera because she said that she didn't want others to have the experience she had of looking at the television and thinking there's no one there who looks like me and no one with the experiences I'm having. She was an incredibly important person in launching the sort of visibility of people with various kinds of disabilities. But she wrote a little essay some years later in which she said that having a disabled child was like the experience of hearing all your friends talk about a trip to Italy, you're planning the trip to Italy, buying the guidebooks, learning the language, getting on the plane, and being told as you came into the airport, welcome to Holland. And she said, if you spent your whole life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Italy, you'll never notice that Holland has windmills and tulips and even Rembrandts, she said. And the pain of not having gone to Italy, which is where you were supposed to go, never leaves you. But if you're only focused on that, you miss so very much. I have to say that this particular passage has not gone down terribly well with the Dutch edition of my book.
Well, I'm also interested in the fact that sort of searching my own memory, I remember people who have children with disabilities saying, you know, I love my child and I'm devoted and it's changed my life and it's broadened my horizons and all of those things. But admitting candidly that they would have preferred the child to have been a normal child.
One of the mothers I interviewed had a son with very severe multiple disabilities who died tragically through caregiver neglect. And at the internment of his ashes, she said, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted and once of the son I loved." And that was what I saw a lot of the time. There was always a yearning for that imagined child who was not affected by a very serious syndrome. But, you know, we care for our children because we love them, of course, but we also love them because we care for them. And for a lot of these parents, that intense process of caring had created a bond that was deep and profound. It didn't take away the sadness that was attached to the children having these conditions. But you asked earlier about love. I found that these parents loved these children at least as much as ordinary parents love ordinary children.
And when Andrew Solomon talks about caring and loving children, he's talking from his own perspective because he has a child now. And in fact, open your book to a section, chapter 12, of Father, I started this book to forgive my parents and ended it by becoming a parent. That was a whole journey, really, wasn't it?
It was a whole journey.
An odyssey.
People said to me as I was working on the book, how can you possibly be writing this book and deciding to have children right when you're in the middle of writing about everything that can go wrong? And I had to say over and over again, it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love and joy there can be even when everything seems to be going wrong. So my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minnesota. I have a daughter with a close friend from college, and mother and daughter live in Texas, where we go to visit them a lot and they come to visit us a lot. And then my husband and I have a son who's with us full time, of whom I am the biological father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate was Laura, the lesbian mother of his two biological children.
So if I can do the arithmetic, five parents of four children in three states.
That's exactly right.
Okay. But it has added to your life enormously, immeasurably, ineffably, to be a father.
Oh, absolutely. And when I was growing up, and this is another central question of the book, I grew up thinking I had to make a choice between having a family, which I wanted more than almost anything, and being true to myself. And so I tried to make relationships with women work because I thought, but I could have a family. And then I would think, no, I can't do this. I'm not being true to myself. And then I would get sad in relationships with men and think, now I'll never have a family. And I grew up in a world in which those two things were irreconcilable. And as an adult, I live in a world in which they're fully reconcilable. And I feel so fortunate to have lived through that dramatic transformation of gayness as an illness to gayness as an identity. And that was the bridge from which I wanted to reach out to other people and say, what other things do we now think of as illnesses can become identities? What other freedoms are there waiting to break through?
It seems to me that we should talk at least a bit about prodigies, because you write about prodigies, and they do fit into this horizontal category too. With them, a whole different set of challenges often.
It turns out that while it's very difficult to have the mind of a 5-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old, it's also very difficult to have the mind of a 30-year-old in the body of a 5-year-old. And a lot of the prodigies who I looked at had to spend time either with intellectual peers who weren't very interested in a five-year-old or with age peers who couldn't understand anything they were talking about. And so it's very isolating. This issue of asynchrony, which is what that's called when your mind and body aren't at the sort of same developmental stage. And by the way, your emotions may be at the level of a five-year-old while your intellect is at the level of a 30-year-old and so on. You know, there are complex variations on it. I set out to do the book thinking, well, I'll have this one cheerful chapter in the middle. But while the revelation of most of the other chapters is you can find meaning and a lot of reward in having a child with autism or Down syndrome, the message of that chapter is this thing of having a child who's a genius sounds so great, but it's actually really, really, really hard. It's not as sad as having a child with a disability, but it's equally difficult. And there was one mother who I was talking to and I said, how do you feel it's been bringing up your son in these circumstances with all the pressures of negotiating his difference? And she said, it's been the same as it would be if he had a wooden leg. And that was really her experience. And I found that there was a lot in common in these families, the same bewilderment, really, at who their children were, and the same very complicated set of questions about what to do. Do you tell your child, okay, you're a genius, we're going to take you out of the mainstream and let you pursue your genius? Or do you tell your child you have to be like everyone else? What is the cost of trying to normalize these differences? When should they be accepted? And when should they be celebrated? And when should they actually be kind of contained so that the child can have more normal experience? They're hard calls.
Holly writes, please have your guests address the question of adopted children and how their search for identity, especially when there is no information about their birth parents, as is often the case with internationally adopted children, though there are a lot of adopted children in the San Francisco area. Even here, children feel different and have additional issues to deal with during normal development stages of forming their identities. My 6-year-old is currently dealing with feeling rejected by her parents in Asia. She's very bonded to me, but is also feeling mad at me for what she imagines was me taking her away from them. Single-parent adoptive families have yet another layer of this feeling different and children envying two-parent families.
I think adoption is an incredibly interesting issue. Within this book, I didn't do a chapter on adoption, though I have adoptive families in almost every chapter. I thought about doing a book about people who set out to adopt disabled children and the questions around that. My next book, the book proposal for which I am just finishing writing, is about the redefining of family in America. And one of the central issues is adoption, especially transnational and transracial adoption, and how adoptive families are the same as or different from the so-called, you know, heteronormative family. Book will also deal with gay families and will deal with single mothers by choice and a variety of other circumstances. I think that being adopted is an identity, and I think being adopted can be a very painful and difficult identity. I found that the adoptive parents I was dealing with were as devoted to their adopted children as they would have been to biological children. But there are stories out there, many in circulation now, about people who have adopted children and then seem to rehome them on the internet and give up on them and so on and so forth. Some very shocking material.
We had Joyce Maynard on. She talked about the fact that she adopted 2 children from Ethiopia and felt she couldn't cope or wasn't right for her or she wasn't a better parent. It would be better if they had 2 parents, including a father, and she essentially found another family for them.
Right.
Here's a tweet from Catherine who writes, why don't you want to hear from adults with special needs? Why focus only on parents and their imaginary perfect kids? Why does everyone obsess on parents with special needs kids and their imaginary perfect kids? Why ask only parents to call in? Your listeners include adults who grew up with disabilities. Nothing about us without us. And thank you for that. I will certainly acknowledge that's fair. In fact, here is one of those adults who writes on our website, Colleen. Says, I've had depression all my life, and then self-medication led to substance abuse. When I had a suicide attempt in high school, my parents kept it very quiet, out of shame perhaps. Now in my 40s, I've learned that my mother attempted to kill herself as a teen, and I wish that she had shared that with me when I was a teen. I thought that I was far from the tree, and now I find that we are actually more alike than she treated me growing up. A Facebook comment from Ginny. Thank you for your topic in Horizontal Children. We have a gifted son with schizophrenia. Life is so difficult. Additionally, our daughter was involved in a very traumatic accident, and both are exceptional, but we exist in profound uncertainty, profound sadness, and profound joy. Thank you for acknowledging this plight. Brian tweets this question, why does the speaker think people in general don't like to be connected or associated with groups they feel are different?
That's an interesting question. I think it relates to the prejudice that exists all the way across our society. I also think, though, that one's own experience gets normalized and then other experience continues to look abnormal. So I always think of the description that one of the women gave to me. She's the mother of a dwarf, about being in the elevator at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She said she was holding her daughter and another woman got into the elevator who was holding her daughter, and the other woman's daughter had Down syndrome. And the mother of the dwarf was looking at the woman with Down syndrome and thinking, I can handle mine, but I couldn't deal with yours. She said, and then I looked up and realized that was exactly the way she was looking at me.
You are hearing this a good deal, though, I imagine, particularly this kind of sentiment that people feel less alone in reading your book and feel more connected.
You know, when I was interviewing the families I talked to, I found myself over and over again talking to people who clearly found it very painful recounting their whole histories. And I would say, tell me why, given how painful it seems to be, why did you decide to tell me your story? And time and again, people said, I felt so alone in the experiences I had, and if telling my story will help others to feel less alone, then I think it's well worth doing. And it's wonderful to feel that that actually happened and that those stories that I was able to absorb are now out in the world and helping people to feel less isolated.
Let me go to an email from a listener named Carolyn who said, I read your book while my son with dwarfism underwent a very painful surgery with a very long recovery, and I loved it. The one thing I think you didn't touch on enough is the way guilt plays into the family dynamic, the guilt that the parents feel for producing the child with a disability who has to go through so much pain, the guilt of putting your child through painful surgeries, the way the child uses guilt for you putting them through painful surgeries, and the guilt you feel for giving so much attention to the disabled child over the non-disabled sibling.
The issue of guilt is tremendous and very central, and one that I encountered over and over again. Of course, there's this long legacy of creating and fostering guilt. You know, it used to be said that children were gay because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. It used to be said that children had autism because of refrigerator mothers. It used to be said they had schizophrenia because their parents nurtured an unconscious wish that they not exist. If you go back a couple of hundred years, there was imaginationism, which was the theory that deformity or dwarfism were caused by the mother's unexpressed lascivious longings. So our tendency to blame parents, even though we've now withdrawn from all of those positions with advancing medical science, remains very strong. And there are some domains in the book in which we still blame parents. We still blame parents if their children are criminals, and sometimes the parents have done a terrible job, and sometimes the parents actually did a good job, and that's just how the kids turned out, you know, as the caller who came just before indicated. I think that was the original nexus of guilt. But I also think that what we want, or one of the things we want as parents, is to spare our children from pain. And if we produce children who have to go through a great deal of pain because of a physical condition, because of a mental illness, for any other reason, we somehow feel as though we've contributed to the pain of the world. The father of one young man with schizophrenia said to me, the only thing that I felt I had to give my children was joy, and I haven't been able to give any of it to this child. It can be a very difficult situation.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead on this Christmas Eve.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.